help guide us and help us to better understand when we find ourselves going through troubled times. This little three-chapter book, tucked away about four books back from the New Testament, if you want to follow along, we're going to be looking at the second chapter this morning. We looked at the first chapter and started with this about 2 weeks ago, and we saw how Habakkuk was just kind of despondent. He saw how his whole community was in a moral and spiritual freefall, and it just seemed like God wasn't doing anything about it, and he literally cries out to God and says, God, why aren't you doing anything about this? And God actually answers him back. And he says, I am doing something about it. I'm bringing the Babylonian people, and they're going to come in and invade you. And so Habakkuk says, well, now I'm really confused. So we said that sometimes trying to understand God, we ask him a question, and he gives us an answer, and then that answer almost creates more questions sometimes. And that's kind of what happened with Habakkuk. And he just felt really out of sorts. This fierce army of the Chaldeans was coming to attack them and take them hostage. And he kind of says in verse 13 of that first chapter, he says, I don't get it. He says, I'm so confused. He says, listen, I know that we, the Israelites, are in bad shape, but there's no way that we're as bad as those Chaldeans, and yet you're going to use them to discipline us? I don't get it. So what he does is he just goes into waiting. He needs another answer from God. He got one answer, but that just created more questions. So then we looked at last week how he just waits for God to answer him again. In those first four verses of chapter 2, we kind of looked at how Habakkuk waits to receive an answer from God. And now this morning we're going to look at God's second answer to Habakkuk, why he's doing what he's doing. And it actually, his answer takes up this whole second chapter, except for the first verse. The remaining 19 verses, 19 out of 20 verses, are God's answer to Habakkuk. So we're going to look at that. And I kind of look at two principles that I extract anyway. There's always so much stuff in God's Word. You can go through it and get something different every time. But what I extract from this are two principles that I think are very important when it comes to dealing with troubled times, and perhaps what we can take from this to help us to deal with troubled times. The first one is that we have to have an understanding with our head where the source of evil is coming from. Habakkuk's going to show us or give us an understanding where the source of evil is coming from. And that's more of an intellectual understanding, to just kind of get a handle on, well, where is this trouble, this evil really coming from? But then the second thing he gives us is he gives us a reassurance for our heart how to face it. So he helps gives us an understanding from where the evil is coming from, but he also gives our heart comfort how we can handle and face the evil. So first, let's just kind of look at some of the clues that Habakkuk gives us as to where the evil is coming from. Now, in our day, and I'm sure it was that way, you know, as Solomon said, there's nothing new under the sun. Often, when we find ourselves in troubled times, especially if it's not just an individualistic troubled time, but maybe it's a society-wide troubled times, like economics, we've seen some more challenging times economically, especially about 5-6 years ago when we had that collapse with Lehman Brothers and Bear Stearns went belly up and all this stuff was happening and people were losing jobs and money. And what do? We start looking for what group of people we can blame for the hard times. Some people say, it's all those, you know, money-hungry businessmen. And then there's other people that say, no, it's not the businessmen. It's that idiotic government that did it. And then some people say, no, it's not the government. In fact, we need more government regulations on these guys so they just don't go hog wild on whatever they want to do. Other people say, no, we don't need any government regulation at all. And what's interesting is, here in the Bible, what Habakkuk does is he doesn't make it that simple. He doesn't make it as simple as just trying to find some people group that we can blame. He does something much more deeper. He goes much deeper than that. Although, if you make a quick reading of this second chapter, you might get the impression that he's just blaming a people group. It looks like he's just talking about these Chaldeans, the Babylonians. And I tried to figure that out. Now, why do some Bible transcripts call them the Chaldeans, other ones call them the Babylonians? What are they, the Babylonians? Are they the Chaldeans? The best I can understand is it was a tribe called the Chaldeans that settled in the southern part of Babylon, and as they took it over, they began known as the people from Babylon, which is the southern part of modern-day Iraq, interestingly. And so it looks like they're blaming these people, these Chaldeans from southern Babylon, as the guilty party. As a matter of fact, 15 of these 20 verses do nothing but talk about all the terrible, nasty stuff that these guys do. And if you just look at that, you think, yep, they're the problem, obviously. Well, let's just take a look at that, because it just gives us a litany, a whole inventory of all this crazy stuff they're doing. And contained within that, God gives five woes to these Chaldean people. Now, let me tell you something. If there's one thing you don't want God to say to you, it's woe. If he says, woe is you, woe. I mean, Jesus said it to the hypocritical Pharisees seven times in Matthew 24. And little nice Jesus is not so nice. Just read those seven woes in there. Woe! So here, Habakkuk is told by God, woe to five different things that these Chaldeans are doing. Webster says this, and interestingly, I think a lot of you probably know, the original Webster Dictionary written by Noah Webster was a Christian. So it's often uses Christian definitions of words and even scripture to get you to understand its use in a sentence. His definition of when God says woe is this: it denotes a condition to be dreaded, possibly signifying impending doom, condemnation, and or the wrath of God. So, you definitely don't want God saying that to you. So let's just take a look at this here. Let's see what he says. I'm not going to read the whole chapter for the sake of time, but we're going to take a look at parts of it. First of all, in verse 5 of chapter 2, he's talking about these Chaldeans, and it says, indeed, wine betrays them. And then he says, he is ignorant, he, referring to the Babylonian people. He is arrogant, rather, proud. He is arrogant and never at rest, because he is as greedy as the grave, and like death, is never satisfied. He gathers to himself all the nations and takes captive all the people. Then the next verse, verse 6, comes one of the woes. Woe to him who piles up stolen goods, referring to make themselves wealthy by extortion. Some translations say, woe to him who piles up stolen goods and makes himself rich with loans. He's up. Okay, then it goes down in verse 9. Woe to him who builds his realm by unjust gain. Verse 12. Woe to him who builds a city with bloodshed. Violence, we see. Then in verse 15 it says, woe to him who gives drink to his neighbors, pouring it from the wineskin till they are drunk, so that he can gaze on their naked bodies. That's really an ancient euphemism that there was gross sexual immorality going on. So the second chapter here, you've got all of this crazy stuff, but what we have to understand is, we could read that and say, well, that's obviously the source of the evil. Look at all this stuff there. They're piling up stolen goods. They've got sexual immorality. They're extortioning. There's all of this crazy stuff. Obviously, Babylon is the source of the evil. Unless you go back to verse 4, then you'll realize that all of this stuff that we've just read are simply the symptoms of the evil, not the source. This is the hat that it's wearing, but it's not the actual cause. Verse 4 says this, "Behold, as for the proud one, pride, his soul is not right within him." Pride can skew the soul, make it so it's not right within us. The Message translates that this way: "Look at the man bloated by self-importance." Another way to say pride. And then he says, not just that it doesn't make the soul right within him, but Peterson translates it this way: "Full of himself, but soul empty." Pride, people, can turn your soul into a spiritual vacuum. It's dangerous. Pride has devastating effects on the soul. The Bible is constantly warning us about it. The NIV puts it this way: "See, he is puffed up." Another way to refer to pride. "His desires are not upright." Your desires, your passions, take on a wrong direction when they are guided by pride and not the Holy Spirit. So Habakkuk tells us the devastating effects of pride here, but then right after that, he gives us the antithesis of what we should be controlled by, of what should be at our base. He's full of pride, the proud one, and therefore his soul is not right within him. But then right on the heels of that, he says this: "But the righteous will live by his faith through loyal and steady believing." Your soul is made alive, but by pride it's made into a vacuum. That's basically what he's laying out the principle here. God's people are not to be full of pride, but to be full of faith. But this second chapter of Habakkuk, you know what it really shows us? It shows us the devastating effects that pride can have on a society when their heart is saturated by it. And then it goes down to list all this crazy stuff. That's not nice. It's not really what you want to be a part of. But it starts off and says that this is the proud one, and now here's what it looks like when it's had its way with a group of people. Here's the devastating results. But here's the thing. Pride literally has the capacity to empty the soul. But when we read this, we say, well, thank God I'm not like that. You know, I mean, I'm not burning down cities and taking people captive. You know what I'm saying? So I'm certainly not involved in any of that stuff. You know, I'm not burning cities. I'm not involved in, you know, drunken sexual immorality. The only problem is Jesus said, you know what? Your thought life counts too. Oh, darn it, man. Just messed me up, you know? Doing good till he said that one. So, maybe so, but the point being is, at the bottom line, it's the same source. We are just as vulnerable to that same source destroying our own lives. Listen, it may be wearing a different hat, and it may, you know, take on some kind of seemingly more harmless form when it comes on us. But the fact of the matter is that pride has the potential to have devastating effects on our soul, just like it did the Chaldeans, regardless of what form it takes on. You know, C.S. Lewis said, "Pride is the great sin." Always remember Chuck Colson. That was one of the most, had one of the greatest impact on his conversion when he read that part in Lewis's Mere Christianity, how pride is the great sin, and he realized how pride had destroyed him spiritually and even career-wise, being involved in the Watergate scandal. Lewis says it's the great sin, it's the essential device It's the utmost evil. In fact, he says, listen, if you can look at all the other sins, adultery, greed, anger, drunkenness, he calls them, he says, you know what? Those things are mere flea bites compared to pride. Can't you just hear him saying that? They are mere flea bites, you know, with his English accent, right? But pride, did you know that pride is really the source underneath the most evilest being in the universe? Pride is what made the devil, people. It's a great sin. Lewis says pride leads to every other vice. It is the complete anti-God state of mind. It's what made the Chaldeans' soul not right within them, and you know what? It's what can make our soul not right within us. And again, it's because we're so vulnerable to it. You know why? Because God has wired us with this need to want to know that somehow I matter. I want to know that somehow I could have a hope that my life counts. Is there something, can we build a monument and just even put a plaque on one of the pews for me, okay? Just so I know that there's some kind of memory, somehow my life counts. But you know what? God put that in us. The problem is we look to our own devices to fulfill that, and then we get filled with pride. And that vacuum is there and only meant to be filled by God Himself. That's how it was with Adam and Eve before the relationship got severed. Man, they didn't have any of this self-conscious insecurities. I can't wait to be like that. I mean, could you imagine that annoying, pesky voice that always wants its own way? It's gone. I can actually care as much and love you guys as much as I do myself. That would be awesome. Just to be read about. They could walk around like that. They were so secure they didn't even have to wear clothes. That's what I always find amazing. To be so, there's no insecurities to the, I mean, let's face it. Yeah, we needed them this winter. But the summer's coming. We really don't need them. You know? There's something else going on there, gang. They were so secure in God, there was no sin. They didn't even know they were naked until then. Then all of a sudden, they were full of insecurity. Sin made them so insecure because they no longer had their security in God. See, what we're trying to do is make ourselves valuable so God will love us. But Adam and Eve knew they were valuable because God does love them. We don't have God's love because sometimes we're making ourselves valuable enough. The only reason we have value is we know that God loves us, but we're always looking to all these other devices to try and get us to feel as though we're valuable. And God says, what happened? Who told you you were naked? This didn't bother you. We don't know how long the paradisal state was going on. The Genesis doesn't tell us. They could have been living for centuries, and then all of a sudden they were aware that they were naked. What happened? This self-conscious insecurity came down on humanity with sin. Don Miller does a great job on this, I think, in a book that he wrote. It's not as popular as Blue Like Jazz book, but it's called, the title for it is Searching for God Knows What. I think that's a great title. I think that's why a lot of humanity is living. Searching for God Knows What. And he uses this, what he calls a lifeboat syndrome that he sees humanity caught in. The way he got this was, he said way back in elementary school, his teacher did some kind of a lesson. I guess it was some kind of a values clarification lesson. Of course, the kids don't know that kind of terminology, but that's really what it was. And what the teacher did is says, listen, I want you to imagine a lifeboat with just five people on it. Okay, here are the five people. There is a lawyer. There is a female doctor. There's a crippled child. There's a stay-at-home mom and a garbage man. The only problem is if you've got to throw one person, one of those people overboard in order to save the ship, in order to save the lifeboat, who are you going to throw over? Well, he said he didn't really remember who they finally decided on. Of course, Charlie, they got to pick on the lawyer. So he said probably it was a lawyer, but we're not really sure, you know. But the point being is that he was trying to say this, that he feels like all of humanity are like those people on the lifeboat. And we're all trying to prove our worth because otherwise we feel like we're going to be thrown off the lifeboat. You know, just like the guy that does the slam dunk or the guy that scores the touchdown. Look at me, I deserve to stay on the lifeboat. It's constantly, and it starts way back in school, doesn't it? Now, I don't know if it's getting better now because, you know, they got this whole bullying campaign going on. I hope so. I'll tell you what, man. I could remember some kids in my school. I agree with Campolo. He says he believes that the typical high school, 2,000 kids, works for about 500 of those kids. The talented kids, the athletic, the smart. And the other 1,500 limp through the hallways of that school feeling as though they've been tossed out of the lifeboat, longing for the day they can get out of that dehumanizing institution. And we're constantly trying to prove ourselves, get our value from what we can do rather than who we are in God. You know, the old saying, he made us human beings, not human doings, but we're always trying to get our value from what we do rather than who we are, who we can be in God. Everybody's running around trying to be more rich, more clever, more good-looking. And you know what it is? Lewis says this, that pride is essentially competitive. That's what it really is. That's what it really comes down to. He says that all the other sins really only end up becoming competitive by accident. But pride is significantly, pointedly competitive. Pride doesn't get any pleasure from having something only out of having more of it than the next person. They're not proud because they're rich or they're good looking or this thing or the other thing. They're proud because they're more rich or they're cleverer or they're better looking than others. If everyone else was equally rich and just as good looking and had just as much, there'd be nothing to be proud about. Nearly all these evils in the world, he says, which people put down to greed or selfishness, are really far more the result of pride. Interesting, in this dissertation of the Babylonians, that's where God starts off. Pride. Their soul's not right in them. And then hang on, because a real mess is coming at that point. And I'll tell you what, in our own personal lives, it'll be no different. Verse 5 describes the form this pride takes on with their culture, probably as much as any of them. Again, he, referring to the Babylonian society, is arrogant, proud, and never at rest, because he is as greedy as the grave and, like death, is never satisfied. He gathers to himself all the nations and takes captive all the people. The reason why this culture is filled with people who are trying to make money and have militaristic power is that at their center, they're proud, they're arrogant, and they're empty. They need to feel valuable. Verse 16 has this implication that they were trying to accrue power and wealth and fill themselves with glory and honor. Again, we may not be burning cities down or taking people hostage, but we just have found other, perhaps more harmless ways to feel important and valuable. You know, I find it interesting that some celebrities are actually honest enough and open enough to really talk about why they sought their fame and their accomplishments. An old interview from years ago. What's cool now is you can kind of Google this. I kind of vaguely remembered it. It was like I think 30 years ago. She's like the same age as me and from the same state as me, Madonna. And I remember she was being interviewed, and I found it. She was talking to somebody. It was in a magazine. And she said this. She admitted that she didn't feel like she was anything special. And then I quote, "When I achieve a new level of celebrity and fame and accomplishment, for a brief period of time, I feel special. Then it goes away and I have to reach further. Verse 5, like death, it is never satisfied." Miller mentions one in his book, Tom Arnold, comedian. He was interviewed regarding his book. I love the name of this book. I should get it sometime. I'm sure Tina and I could really relate to it. We could have wrote the book. It's called How to Lose 5 Pounds in 6 Years. That's the exact diet I've had for years now. But, he was beaten. I don't know if it was a TV interview or a radio interview, okay? And they asked him, why did you write the book? He gave the most honest-to-God answer I've ever read from anybody. Here's what he said. "Most entertainers are in show business because they are broken people looking for affirmation. The reason I wrote this book is because I wanted something out there so people would tell me they liked me. It's the reason behind almost everything I do." And the interviewer fell silent for a little while and then said, "Well, you're not alone." Boy, Tom, you're not. How many times do I go through my whole gymnastics on a Sunday, either before service or after service, and ask myself the same questions, and I have to concede that sometimes my motives of faith take a back seat to wanting to just be validated and have a nice message so I can get patted on the back, rather than burdened for your actual souls. I'm just glad Tom Arnold let me know I'm not alone. Pride. Pride. The reason that Chaldeans are burning down cities, people, and the reason Tom Arnold is writing a book, embarrassingly, sometimes why I preach a sermon, and while you're out there trying to advance in your career or do a million other things, is because we're insecure. We fall into the trap of looking to what we can accomplish to support my ego rather than the kingdom of God. We look to pride in ourselves rather than God for our worth. We're trying really, really very hard to cover ourselves with honor. We want to feel beautiful. We want to feel loved. We want to feel significant. That's why we're working so hard, and that's the source of the evil. That's the source. It's not them over there. It's not here over there. It's the source is often pride. That's where it was right here. And then the final manifestation of it is given in verses 18 and 19. Here's what it finally comes down to and what it makes, what it creates. Verse 18, "Of what value is an idol, since a man has carved it, or an image that teaches lies? For he who makes it trusts in his own creation. He makes idols that cannot speak." And there it is. Woe to him. Any life, any culture that is not based on the glory and grace of God will be based on an idol. Preaching can be an idol. A career of pastoring a church or running a hair salon or working or whatever it is, we can take these things and try and get our value and our self-esteem from those things when it only can really be fulfilled through God Himself. I've said this before, let me just say it again. An idol can be anything, people. Often it's a good thing. It could be your family. What it is when we take a good thing and we make it an ultimate thing. When it's a relative thing and we make it an absolute. Anything we make so central that we can't have a meaningful life without it is an idol. We get into all these things trying to, and they're good things. They are good. No good gift comes from God Himself. But when we make them into ultimate and we can't have a meaningful life unless they're in place, we've got an idol on our hands. Pride makes them into idols. Verse 18 says, "For he who makes it trusts in his own creation, he makes idols." Anything. It could be a book, a career, a bank account, a relationship, your family. In Bible times, they bow down to statues, but you certainly don't need a statue. You hardly ever do. Because it's about spiritual idolatry. So that's the source of evil. That's what we have to understand with our heads and be aware of. In troubled times, that's the source. Secondly, how about a comfort for our hearts when we're going to face evil? What's interesting is God gives this scenario of like almost a full 20 verses, and they're dark. I mean, they're piling up, they're stolen goods, there's extortion, there's sexual immorality, there's bloodshed, there's violence. And then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, he'll give you these flashes of light. Like right in the middle of it, all of a sudden, there's a statement about God and how good he is and his glory in the middle of all the darkness. You're reading through all this stuff. They're piling up stolen goods. Verse 6, verse 9, they builds up his realm through unjust gain. Verse 12, bloodshed and violence. And then all of a sudden, you come on verse 14, and out of nowhere it says, "For the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord as the waters cover the sea." And then you start reading again, and it goes into the him who gives drink, and the drunkenness and the immorality, and then the idols. And then at the end, all of a sudden, another flash of light. It says, "But the Lord is in his holy temple. Let all the earth be silent before him." Right in the midst of all of the darkness, all of the craziness, there's these flashes of light. I think ultimately what God is just saying in the middle of all the craziness is, once again, he's telling us, "I'm in control. I'm still here." As much as it seems crazy and contradictory and doesn't make sense, all this bad stuff happening under the supervision of a good God, what kind of contradiction is this? You know what some theologians call this? I came across this word, new word for Scrabble, never saw it before. Antinomy. I've never heard of that one before. And I did go, you know, I'm getting better on a computer. You know, you can go to the dictionary and it will pronounce it for you. So I can sound like I know what I'm talking about. Antinomy. A paradox is a contradiction, but an antinomy is an apparent contradiction. It just looks like a contradiction. It looks like things are out of control. It looks like the Babylonians are having their way and they're persecuting God's people. But it only is an apparent contradiction. God is in control of the whole thing, and he's still guiding it to fulfill his destination. I mean, would the ultimate antinomy be the cross? I mean, does that look like a contradiction or what? I mean, for centuries, the Jewish people are waiting for the Messiah. He's going to deliver us. He's going to rescue us. Finally, Jesus comes on the scene. He's got to be the Messiah. I mean, he's raising dead people. He's the Messiah. Then all of a sudden, he's arrested, and nailed and killed and dying on a cross. And it's like, well, so much for Israel being saved. But it's an apparent contradiction. Because as they're saying so much for Israel being saved, guess what? Israel is being saved at that very moment by him being up on the cross and dying. It looks like a contradiction, gang, but it's not a contradiction. So don't ever be fooled by evil times. Sometimes God does his most strategic work in troubled times. Sometimes, you know, Jesus, when he talked about the cross, remember one time he said, carry your cross? I think he's implying there that the cross, when you look at that cross, don't just think, now you need to think this, but don't limit it just to a symbol of how we're saved. It's also a symbol of how God works in our lives. Sometimes it's troubled times that he does his most strategic work. His most strategic work in all of humanity looked like the biggest contradiction there ever was, but it was only an apparent contradiction. And we still have a hard time trusting in it, so we try to go to all of these things to clothe ourselves with glory, to make ourselves look more valuable, to feel better about ourselves. Meanwhile, there was only one person who was really covered with glory, who was really full of honor, and that was Jesus Christ. And Philippians 2 tells us that he emptied himself of all of that stuff. He became what we are so we could become what he is. He took on our shame so we could have his honor. So when we say, when we come to this table and we say, Father, accept me on the basis of what Jesus has done, at that moment we need to understand that we're clothed with his beauty, we're clothed with his honor, we're clothed with his righteousness, we're beautiful in his eyes, and we don't need to just struggle to win at all costs anymore. We don't need to struggle to achieve at all costs. We don't need to use people to win at all costs. As a matter of fact, now we can serve people. We're freed up to serve people. We can serve them. And we no longer have to be part of the problem in a troubled situation or a troubled culture. We can actually be part of the solution. You know what I love? There's so many of these antinomies in the gospel. The gospel humbles us. Check this out now. The gospel humbles us out of our pride, but in such a way that we have more confidence than we ever had before. You think, geez, Greg, you know, you're really beating us down. You tell us we can't feel good about it. But you know what? The gospel removes our pride in such a way that we have more confidence than ever. How does it remove our pride? Well, let me tell you, this is pretty humbling, isn't it? We come to this table, and he says, do this in remembrance of me. We have to remember that my sin actually cost God's son his life. Kind of humbling. My body should have been broken, but instead it was his body that was broken in my place. My blood should have been shed, but instead it was his blood in place of mine that was shed. But where do I get the confidence? Lewis Smedes, I love this statement. I've used it many times. You'll probably recognize it. He said, it was a terrible thing. A terrible thing that Jesus had to die for us. But it's a wonderful thing that he considered us worth dying for. Worth dying for. He considered you worth it. There's where you get your self-worth. There's where your soul's confidence needs to be anchored in. I feel like just giving it one of those selahs right now. You know, that's what the psalmist did, man. He'd make a nice statement, just be like, think on that one. Just you chew on that for a little while. Well, that's what we're going to do. I want you to think about these things, selah. Meditate on them. And once we've all been given the elements for communion, like we normally do, we'll take them together. I'll ask the ushers if they wouldn't mind.